Gorgeous George and Ghost, are you ready? Junkie Nation, are you ready? Well, let's get it on!
From the fight capital of the world, Las Vegas, Nevada, this is MMA Junkie Radio.
We rollin'!
What's going on, Junkie Nation? Gorgeous George and Ghost checking in here on a Sunday night for your Monday morning delivery. We're pumped up, man, to talk about UFC 299. Can't imagine there'll be too much other than UFC 299 talk. No guests. We just got to unpack this wild card, this deep card. Do we have a guest, Ghost?
I think we do, right?
You tell me.
Yeah,
maybe I was wrong. I have no problem admitting I'm wrong.
Yeah, we have one.
Brandon Royval. Yes, we did an interview with Brandon Royval very recently. So we'll play that for you. He's very relevant. He, of course, is trying to get on the 301 card against Alexander Pantoja out in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. He just beat Brandon Moreno recently at the UFC Mexico City card. So we'll talk to him. We'll talk about UFC 299, and there's a couple of big stories from the world of boxing. We'll talk about that as well. We'll be right back to start the show. All right, so, dude, I was thinking about this. Sean O'Malley impressed me so much. I don't know that I can find the right words to describe everything I want to say about the guy. When someone goes out there and for 25 minutes just steps on the gas, you know, the gas pedal nonstop, trying to finish his opponent, man, I have a big appreciation for that. This dude could easily tell after two rounds he was the better man. He was going to get his hand raised, and yet he just, you know, kept going. He shows up to the post-fight press conference already in a boot. So it's a foot injury that he's had in the past. He kind of has a good idea of what it is. Doesn't think it's serious, but either way, I mean, he's messed up, man. His hands hurt. But I mean, I can't ask more from a fighter than what he did. He really did go out there and try and finish Marlon Vera, after proving he was better than Marlon Vera across the board on all the judges' scorecards.
Yeah, it was a great performance for him. It was a mixture of things, too, where Marlon Vera just needs to cut the shit already with this, like, taking so long to get going. You know, you see him in round three and four, and you're like, why didn't you fight like this in round one and two? Like, why are you just handing somebody round? Now, I don't really think it would have mattered, although Sean looked, you know, pretty tired, and I wouldn't say battered, because battered is what Cheeto looked like, but he looked like he had been through a battle too, you know. At the end, it kind of makes you wonder what would happen if he would have had that pace from the get-go. But everything about that performance from Sean O'Malley was just awesome. His timing, his speed, his reactions, his choice of strikes, when to throw them, how pinpoint he was. Like, it was pretty damn good, all of it. And I'd say it again, you know, I always say this, but from fight to fight, this guy has been improving a lot.
He has. That was a really, really vintage performance. A guy against the guy who had beat him once. And I can't say enough about it. I mean, think about it. These guys are 1-1, and I have zero interest in seeing them again. I mean, unless Cheeto wins three in a row and brutally beats either Sanhagen or Dovalishvili along the way, I just really don't have too much interest. It looks like the point's been made. And now I'm wondering, this is a tease for Spinning Backlick, our weekly Monday show live, noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific. How good can O'Malley be on this run? Now he's got, well, now that I think about it, goes, he's got three tough tests. He's got Mrav Dvalishvili, Corey Sanhagen, and Umar Nurmagomedov. Now, I think of those three, two will fight each other and knock the other guy off. So we might not have to sweat all three. But either way, if he can get past the next couple, the record for most title defenses for the UFC bantamweights is Dominic Cruz with three, Aljamain Sterling with three. However, I tend to give Cruz those two that he had at WEC because at that time, WEC housed the best bantamweights in the world. So I feel like I give him those two. So the record for bantamweight title defenses is five. Can he get there? I don't know, man. But God, he really impressed the hell out of me last night.
You know, it's tough to say because right away, the first guy that stands in front of him could be his kryptonite, right? Sean O'Malley can't fight that type of fight against a guy like Merab Dvalishvili. He's not going to be able to strike that way. He might not even have any space to do anything, really, because Dvalishvili is just in your face from the get-go. And if you can't stop those takedowns, you're in for some trouble. Now, has Dvalishvili been rocked before? Of course he has. But that first challenge in front of him is rough. Then from that, even then, those are pretty tough ones in front of him as well. I'm going to probably lean towards no, which I feel ridiculous because I'm always picking against Sean O'Malley. I can't even give him the benefit of the doubt here in the next fight. But what he's done and what he's accomplished to this point is amazing. Now, in that division, let's just say we had a magic wand and it was Merab on that side and he's got to go through those three guys. I'd probably say the same thing. Like, maybe he gets through one, but he can't get through them all. That's just how competitive that division is.
Yeah. I mean, it really is. It's like a car wash. Oh, no, that's not the right word. It's a murderer's row to no matter who it is, whether it's Nurmi, if he held the belt, I would say he's got to get through Sanhagen, Merab, O'Malley. If it was Sanhagen holding, I would say the same thing. I mean, it is a murderer's row. I don't think he can get through it, but I also thought last night's fight was going to be a lot closer. I also thought Vera didn't start as slow as he normally does. But once he got hit with that knee, he wasn't the same. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this guy O'Malley would not stop coming at him with one simple 1-2s. Then he'd go to the body. Then he'd try kicking him all over the body, the legs, the head. I mean, it was just an onslaught of strikes. It was really, really impressive. Only at the end was he finally tired, and it was because with like 1 second to go, Vera landed a beautiful body shot. But other than that, he just didn't seem too concerned with anything Cheeto had to offer, and he just kept running through it. Well, I mean, of course, he probably got hurt a couple times, but for the most part, he was just like on a mission to finish Cheeto, and he didn't get it. But still, mm-hmm. I was impressed.
Here's how I kind of look at things. I think fighters can be good. Then I think there's fighters that are really good. And then there are fighters that are great. I feel like last night, Sean O'Malley went from being good to really good. If he can get through the next couple guys, he might have to jump into great status, right? I think that's why we're talking about records and all that. But for me, he kind of, all those people that say, I mean, they're kind of not wrong when they're saying the road might have been a little easier. Yeah, I get that. But he kind of did the best that he could with what was given to him. I think last night he became really good.
Yeah, the only thing I can say is it was weird because I kept getting something from ESPN Plus saying save $10 on UFC 299. So I thought, okay, sales must be slow. But at the same time, I think they shattered the record of 14 million at the gate. Crowd was nuts. I don't know how it sold on pay-per-views, but Dana's saying, hey, this guy's slowly getting into that next step of being a superstar. He didn't say he's ready to take over Conor McGregor or nothing like that, but he did make it sound like this guy's slowly becoming one of the top stars in the UFC itself. It's hard to take Dana at his word sometimes with what he's saying or what he's getting across or whatever, because why would you offer $10 off to a pay-per-view if it's selling well? You know right. what I mean? And I remember Aljo going out of his way, and Aljo looks like a pretty responsible guy. You can bash him for whatever you want, but it seems like when he talks, he doesn't lie. He said, he thought he was him versus O'Malley was going to do better. It didn't do better. So, but that doesn't mean I didn't think O'Malley was a stud on Saturday night. So we mm-hmm. shall see. I like him thinking about Topuria, but it's too soon. It's such this, I don't know, like he says it, I appreciate it, but part of me is like, oh, come on, bro. Seriously? Like, you know, like relax a little bit here. You got Merab. It's clear cut Merab. Like, you know how I would think he knows how the public and the media feels about super fights. Just no, you know, no on mm-hmm. that one.
Yeah. I'm not going to lie. It's intriguing on paper, but it doesn't really, it's just not the time or place. If I'm the UFC, I mean, it's pretty damn obvious they love that kid. They have certain fighters that they really like. And to me, I don't think they would put him in that position. It doesn't make too much sense to me. But I think he just likes... See, the thing is, when he says things like that, George, I think 50% of the public is smart enough to go, that ain't going to happen. But there's the other side, the other 50 that go, hey, that would be fun. Imagine if they did it this way or this and that. I think he just kind of likes to flex a little bit. Like, I can maybe try and do this if I want. But yeah, it's not really realistic.
And that's kind of what he was doing. He kind of made it sound like, hey, I'm pretty legit. If I want to fight at 142, I think he said, I think I can. If I want to fight at 140, I think I can. You know, he kind of said a few things that kind of had a little arrogance to him, which I don't mind. I don't mind him kind of flexing a little bit, but flex on stuff that is not feasible, but digestible. You know, like Ilia Topuria is not digestible. I mean, we're considering whether he should fight Volkanovski because Volkanovski held the title for so long and he deserves a rematch. Or we're considering whether they should take Gaethje and Max apart and have Max fight. Or whether Max would fight anyway because we'd give Volkanovski enough time off to recover from two consecutive concussions that he's a no-brainer. Or did Ortega do enough? Like, literally, we got that. We got that filled, you know? We don't need to hear you say that. Now, if someone asks you, hey, if you were to run the next three in a row, would you be open to a super fight? Okay, but that's just me. I'm not others. I'm sure you're right, and others do think some stuff's pretty cool, especially a hardcore Sean O'Malley nut hugger, but I'm an MMA nut hugger, and no, I'm ready to see O'Malley versus Merab. It doesn't have to be tomorrow, by no means. Sometime in the summer is fine. No rush. Get healthy, everyone. Let's see it, but that's the number one contender fight for me. And I'm willing to see Sanhagen and Nurmi. And I think Sanhagen said so as well, as long as he's next. And that's the thing. We don't know, because if Merab and O'Malley sells a ton and it's a classic, they may want to run it back. So you're never going to get that promise, Corey Sanhagen.
Yeah, it's so odd because, like, even if it was great, I wouldn't want to watch it. I'm so over rematches, George. I think it only makes sense to run one back like that if it's just not so much that it's an absolute classic, but if it's somebody that just held on to their title for a really long time. Like, I think they kind of earn the benefit of getting another shot. But I think just because it was a good fight doesn't, that seems more like a money thing to me. And I think we're just getting so far away from sport. There's so many people in that division that have worked hard to get to where they're at that I don't know. Controversy, you know, is another reason why you would run something back. But I'm just so sick of rematches, dude, over and over and over.
Me too. And over the weekend, we heard that Alexa Grasso and Valentina Shevchenko are going to coach Tough 31 or whatever they're going to call it, or 32, I think they're at, which tells us they're probably going to fight later in the year. It sounds like the show is going to be broadcasted in June, so they're going to start filming it pretty soon. I think there's a media day this Monday in Las Vegas, and then they'll start filming. 6 weeks it usually takes. They'll cut it up, edit, splash the show in June sometime, which is before Dana White Contender Series. And then they fight at the end of that series, which tells me probably UFC Sphere is Grasso versus Shevchenko. Now, what am I getting at? We get to see him a third time. you know, once the fight gets here, of course I'm pumped up about it. But I am a little bummed because you got some really, really talented flyweights that are just kind of in this holding pattern, fighting each other, knocking each other off while this thing plays out slowly. And add one more to the mix because Macy Barber looked pretty good on Saturday night too.
Yeah, she did. This, for me, is kind of, I feel like it has the ability to be either, there's going to be nothing in the middle. It's either going to be awesome or it's going to suck. Because,
which one, tough?
Yeah, because look, coaches, I think, are the ones that sell the show. They're the reason why you tune in. It's not so much who's on the show and all that. And sometimes you could see Valentina Shevchenko be very, like, competitive. I mean, I think she's always competitive, but sometimes you can see when she's poked a little bit, it comes out. It's come out with Amanda Nunes, right, before in the past. Alexa's a little bit more chill and a little bit more respectful. If you poke her a little bit, she'll come back, but not too much. So I don't know. I don't know how much those two are going to go at each other. And you have to really, really sit there and promise that these two are going to fight, because after Michael Chandler and Conor McGregor, you're like, what the fuck? Like, you sold us the whole season that you guys are going to fight, and now there's no fight, right? So hopefully something like that changes a little bit. I think it'll be fun. Like I said, I think it's either going to be really good or it's going to be an absolute dud. But the fight itself, I'm down for it.
The fight itself, I'm down for. The show, I'm completely over it. I'm all about Dana White Contender Series, and whatever money you put into the show, I'd rather have a winter series of Dana White Contender Series. I don't even care if it's 5 weeks. I'm just not into tough at all anymore. I think the only thing that might be interesting is a coach's challenge. And I'm sure when there is a fight and it's good, okay, but did I need to really see it on delay? Why can't I watch it live on a Tuesday? I don't know. I'm just over it. Now, as far as them two, I thought Michael Bell's the one that left us hanging. It should have been Valentina Shevchenko as champ. If you want to go for the trilogy, sure. If you want to do it in Sphere, sure. If you want to do it in Mexico, okay. But, you know, we got the draw. So we got a 1-0-1 series, and this is the trilogy. But what if Valentina wins? Then what? 1-1-1? Are we going the route of Figgy and Marino? Like, come on already. You got Blanchfield. You got Ferrant, Barber. Hell, Talia Santos already took off her PFL, if I'm not mistaken. So that's the one that gave Valentina really, really scare, a big scare. Now, she lost the fight since then, but I don't think that meant she needed to leave altogether, but it's just so congested. I don't know, frustrating. But let's get back to UFC 299. Dustin Poirier against Benoit Saint-Denis. I remember saying the longer the fight goes, the more favorites Poirier. Benoit Saint-Denis is going to be a beast early on, and he was. He got takedown. Okay, I was saying Benoit Saint-Denis, I knew that he'd be tough early on. He wound up telling us post-fight that he only had one round in him because he was taking antibiotics. I don't know if it had to do with that, whatever it was he had that, you know, on his forehead. That looked gross, by the way. Looked like a big runaway zit. It looked like he got shot in the head. I don't know what it looked like, but was it that? Was it something else? I don't know. Poirier gave him his due, said he was heavy-handed, he was strong. But in the end, man, Poirier weathered that storm and then came back and smacked him around, got the finish, and it was just what the fight card needed. Because we had a lot of decisions on this fight night. I'm not saying the fight night, or sorry, on this UFC pay-per-view. I'm not saying it was boring and all that, but I just remember the card needed something as we were getting closer to the main event, and Poirier delivered it.
Yeah, that was that moment, I think, where everybody jumps out of their chairs. The pay-per-view had everything, man. It was just really, really fun. But that moment in particular, like, even trying to predict that fight, there were so many different ways of looking at it. And in a way, I don't think anybody was really wrong. Even the people that were saying Benoit Saint-Denis is one of the next biggest things and he's going to do this and do that, he showed signs of that. You know, he can still maybe develop into being that type of fighter. But this night, it was just too much on Dustin Poirier's side. despite Dustin Poirier repeatedly going after that guillotine, which I think had he not done that, he probably could have saved himself a couple shots because he was having luck on the stand-up. But he kept going for it over and over and over again. But that moment when he finally cleaned his clock and poof, Jesus, the follow-up punch was brutal. It just kind of showed that Dustin Poirier is still a force. How long is he going to be a force? I don't know. Because in the fight, you can just tell, like, he's just a little slower to react. But he was so good that I think even a Dustin Poirier that's at, like, 90% is still better than a lot of lightweights. So now we just got to see what we do moving forward. It's so log jammed and there's so many different scenarios. Basically, we just have to wait for UFC 300 to unfold and then go from there.
I was right that Poirier would make some of the takedowns easy because VSD could get the fight to the ground. But every time he did, he had to fight off a choke before he could get anything going. And now with everything we heard about him, you know, not being 100%, you just got to believe that he did have that one round or two rounds in him. And after that, Poirier was going to piece him up. So what I don't like about this, and somebody online said it, I think it was Ant Evans or Ben Folks. They said, bro, you got to do a better job of delivering that message. You sound like a sore loser right now. Funnel it through your camp, leak it through your camp. Let them say it so it doesn't come from you. And then you don't look like a sore loser, you know. And if it was true, okay, cool, but we don't know that. If it isn't true, that Poirier may not have touched your chin anyway, so right. You know, at this point it's real petty for him to say that. You got to give Poirier his flowers. The only thing that now we have to talk about is Poirier could have a title shot. And I'll tell you why. Because Ali Abdelaziz, Islam Makhachev's manager, tweeted out that because Gaethje, you know, or he said all other contenders, and I think that means his other client, Gaethje, along with Charles Oliveira and Armand Sarukian, they're all booked. Whereas right now, Poirier, he gave a young guy a shot in BSD. He looked great. He's got an incredible resume. Him and Makhachev can get down in June in Saudi Arabia. It sounds like the Makhachev camp is into it. I want to know, goes, and this is going to be on Spinning Backclick tomorrow, so this is a chance to get your thoughts together, but it's just too big to talk about. Are you into it?
I don't think it's right, but if there's anybody that deserves maybe a little bit of this tomfoolery, it could be a guy like Dustin Poirier. He might have just earned that, you know? But boy, like, what you're saying to, like, okay, what you're saying to Charles Oliveira, right? I mean, there's so many different ways of looking at it. Charles Oliveira's had his shot, and he missed out. He lost. But Charles Oliveira has beaten both of these guys, right? So if you put one of them in front of him, that's got to be his first argument is, well, wait a minute. We're all kind of on the same trajectory, but I've beaten both of them. If you do Justin Gaethje, well, that's kind of weird too, right? Because Justin Gaethje's got, like, Poirier's kind of the man on the outside of all of this. At least Gaethje could say, well, I haven't had that shot yet, and I got to win over here over Poirier. So really, it all just comes down to the perfect timing. If that's something that just cannot be avoided and has to be done at that time, I think you can talk people. I think people can stomach it just because it is Dustin Poirier. And I feel like he just has this ticking clock that we're all starting to see. Maybe you could stomach it, but is it right? No. But if has anybody ever earned the opportunity to be that guy, it's probably him.
Yeah. I mean, Gaethje clearly beat him for the BMF title. And I feel like he's in front, but I guess by Gaethje accepting the Holloway fight, which I think comes with pay-per-view points, it's a title fight in a way, he basically gave way to something like this opening. As far as Oliveira is concerned, he had that title fight locked up, but he got hurt, he got cut, and Armand Sarukian built his name up, and so now they tied those two up. I guess what he could have said was, nah, I don't want Armand Sarukian, I'll wait for Makhachev, but he didn't. But what kind of intel was he getting? I don't know. So I think I'd be okay with it. It wouldn't be my first choice, but I think I could stomach it.
Yeah, that's the thing, is we'd have to stomach it. But because really, when you just break down the formula, no matter how you look at it, Dustin Poirier is the third guy in line there.
Yeah, I agree.
But I think we all also understand that there probably is something to the bravery that he showed, you know, taking a top contender, probably being somewhat easy to work with throughout his career. You know, the first thing Justin Gaethje is going to say is, I need this amount of time. I only do it this way. Charles Oliveira is kind of a nutcase sometimes when it comes to negotiations. So who knows, man? Maybe this is kind of the UFC's way of proving a point too. We'll see.
If they fight in June, let's just say Gaethje wins and Oliveira win. They might have to fight each other, because how do you decide between them? I guess Oliveira does have the win. Gaethje would still be the BMF or the title defense. Like, that one's even kind of confusing as to who would go first. They might have to fight each other. So by this happening, Gaethje and Oliveira might cost themselves about 9 months before they even get to a title fight.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. It's a pretty weird situation. It's a good one to have if you're the UFC, but holy crap, man, to make those two square off again, like, that would really suck for them.
If BSD had won, he probably would have got the loser of the Makhachev sweepstakes. What do I mean by that? Let's say Oliveira wins and Gaethje wins. Well, one of them fights Makhachev. The loser would be the loser of the Charles or the Islam Makhachev sweepstakes. They would fight BSD, but it didn't work out that way. Poirier kind of spoiled a lot of things. But damn, did that crowd go crazy for the guy or what? You can just tell he's a star, and the UFC wants to feature him in big fights. But can they sneak him into a title fight? I don't know, but we know the Makhachev camp is ready. Tell you what, we'll obviously keep talking about this as we find out more, but right now is a good time to get our guest in, and then we'll come back and keep talking about this wild weekend, including the rest of the UFC 299, the results, and all the stuff that happened in Saudi Arabia. We'll be right back with Brandon Roybal. What's up, Junkie Nation? Gorgeous George and Goes reporting for duty here. Get to talk to one of our favorites, Brandon Roybal. He's coming off a huge win out in Mexico City over Brandon Moreno. Might have cemented himself a title shot. We'll talk about that. Also joined by his dog, Oso. How old is Oso, Brandon?
Oso is like 1 and 3 months.
He's combo, like, is he a Labradoodle? Or yeah, like
he's a mini Labradoodle, so he's not going to get too big.
Dude, yeah, we've seen him before. He's cool. For those that are tripping, he's got the AC on. He just went for a walk, so we got a responsible dog owner here with us. What's going on, though, with the hairnet? You got a shift to put in at Chipotle or something, or what?
I woke up and threw it on, and I just mistimed, like, between this meeting and the podcast.
You sure you're not working the grill somewhere, making some extra money at some coffee shop?
Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to make my hair go backwards. Honestly, it's been an adventure. I have to wear the hairnet kind of all the time. So, yeah, you guys are witnessing that. But, you know, yeah. I'm trying to cement my Chicano legacy out here in Colorado.
Do you have some Hispanic blood in you?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Wasn't sure. Roybal sounds, white, I guess. But yeah, third generation, right? Is it on your mom's side or what?
I wonder what that is. Like, I don't know where my last name comes from. And, like, it makes zero sense to me.
The Chicano side on your dad's side?
Both sides. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
What was I gonna say? Dang. Yeah. But my ancestry is like, comes from like Native American roots and like Spain. So virtually Mexican at that point.
Yeah. All right. So the fans. What was it like in Mexico? Were you like enemy 101, or was there some love?
No, I got a lot of love out there, honestly. I feel like there's a lot of people that were, like, maybe not cheering for me, but at least had respect for me. So anytime I, like, left the hotel or when I would go into the hotel lobby, I was taking pictures, shaking hands. all the above along the way. So it wasn't like I was like worried too much or anything like that.
Do you speak Spanish?
No, I don't.
No? Okay. All right. Well, hey, what was it like hearing the scorecards and seeing the scorecards? And if you rewatched the fight, I mean, it was literally a landmine looking at the first three rounds. I think the last two rounds were consistent with the way the judges scored it, but otherwise it was all over the place. Were you tripping at the end when they were calling out the names?
Yeah, and then like even looking at the scorecards now, some of it doesn't make sense to me, because I think the only like real controversial round was the second round. The first round was weird, but I'd give it to him. The second round, I still think I won just based off of like attacking. I feel like maybe people gave it to him because of takedown, but it's just like when you get the takedown, in my opinion, or like how I score fights, is like you need to do something with it. And if you're defending submissions off the takedown, like I just score it. But the second round was a controversial one. The weird one for me is that nobody scored me the fifth round except for everybody else in the goddamn world besides the judges. But the fifth round is like, I thought I won that too. The only thing he did is he landed like maybe a couple punches, but then he was like holding on. And that's where like, I guess you can maybe give it to him a little bit. But that being said, is like, as far as the fifth round goes, I think anybody else besides the judges scored it for me. So that was a weird one for me too. And then the 49-46 made zero sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got the job done. Your hand did get raised, so it worked out for you. And you recently fought him. Yeah. But at the same time, this isn't a deep division. There's also a few injuries. There's a few vets that have dropped some fights. So there's a case for you to be made to fight again, especially in Brazil, because you said you can turn it around and make 301. Is that still the case? Your body feeling good?
Yeah. I'm getting through some injuries, but like I have plenty of time to go get ready for 301, especially that I'm like in great shape. I've been back-to-back fights, and it's just like I've never really left that like 25-minute ready to get out of fight shape. So I'll be back in the gym really soon. But by 301, I'll be healthy and ready to go and be perfectly in shape to go win a belt. I'm his most recent fight. And same thing with Brandon Moreno, too. It's like Brandon Moreno was his most recent fight before then. And like we were kind of in the same situation. You know what I'm saying? So But I've made improvements quick. And it's just like Brandon Moreno did take me down twice in that fight. For the most part, he couldn't get me down. My wrestling defense was on point. I got right back up. I attacked submissions. I did everything that I wanted to kind of show that I did wrong in that Pantoja fight. It was like, I'm not getting held down. I'm going to get up every time, and I'm going to threaten submissions the whole entire time if I'm not on my way up.
Is there a drawback to getting passed over? I mean, they were saying if Mokaev maybe had an emphatic win, he could go and do it. He hasn't faced the champion. He's undefeated. So is there a drawback? And here's why I say that. You know, obviously, if you want to fight for the title, you obviously should campaign for it. I get it. But I think back to DDP, right? He beat Whitaker, and then they go, okay, so it's you and Izzy in September. Kind of a quick timeline, like similar to what you're facing. And he goes, nah, I'm good. And so he sits back, lets Strickland beat Izzy, which I don't know if he thought that would happen or not. And then he sits back, bides his time, and then – perfect scenario, you know, he fights in Toronto healthy, wins the title. So being patient worked out. Now Dana White will often say if you get passed over, things might not work out for you, and that has happened as well. So if you had a time to really calmly assess the situation and not rush into anything, you know, like these, because these obviously are grueling training camps, and then you did go 25 at fucking 10,000 feet altitude, which is very impressive. So have you thought about that scenario?
I have, and it's just like I don't really know if I want to sit out really either. It's just like I want to fight. I'm in a good situation right now where I can make a lot of money this year. If I could fight for a belt, that would be the most ideal situation. It's just like I don't really know who else they're gonna give it to. So in that situation, just like if they give it to me, I'm going to be ready for that fight no matter what. And I'll take that fight. But maybe like not fighting in 2 months. 2 months seems really, really soon. Like 3 months, 4 months. Perfect. But I don't want to wait around. I just I feel like I can pick up a role right now. I feel like I can clear the division. At least to a certain degree. Like, I was looking over the top five. I beat everybody in the top five except for Amir Albazi, and that's the only person I haven't faced. And other than that, I beat every single person besides Amir Albazi in the top five. So it's like, I feel like I'm doing a good job clearing out the division. From one side, it's like I just have to be undeniable to win this belt and to get my situation. And it's like, I'll defend my number against anybody in this world. Anybody, any of these flyweights, I believe I could beat. But whatever's going to give me the title of the quickest is what I'm looking for.
So if they did something where they said, well, all right, because I think Mokai have kind of presented that, right? Like, what if we fight and then whoever fights or whoever wins that goes on and fights for the title? Would you even be willing to do something like that? And if not, do you feel like eventually, because of the way the division is, you feel like you're just going to end up fighting them anyway at some point?
Yeah, for sure. Me and that kid are definitely going to fight at some point. I feel like him pressing really hard for a fight with me right now is a dumb idea, because it's like, if you look at the division, it's either me or him getting the title shot. It's like, bro, campaign for Pantoja. That would be the smart move, you know, is campaign for Pantoja. That's what I'm trying to do. Is just, I want the Pantoja fight. The Mokai fight will happen eventually, but it's just like, I want the Pantoja fight. I'll be ready by 301. I can make that quick of a turnaround, and I'm confident I'll beat Pantoja more than anything. So it's just like that in my head. It's just, I want Pantoja. My eyes are on Pantoja. My eyes are always going to be in front of me. And that's what I want. I want to be a champion. I want to win the belt. I would love to win the belt in Brazil. I feel like that these are all dreams come true, you know, and those are what I want. And that's like, I don't really see another athlete besides possibly me or Makayev that are going to be ready for that fight. So it's just like, that's the fight I want. That's the fight I'm aiming for. Pantoja is going to be the one that I'm going to be calling out every second every chance I get. Any platform I have, I want Pantoja. I want Pantoja. I want the number one spot. I want to be the champion. And from there on out, I'll fight any of these dudes. I'll fight whoever's next. And that's going to be my mentality for the rest of it. It's just like, ever since I've been in the UFC, I've had some of the hardest fights. I've had some of the hardest fighters, some of the best fighters in the world, you know? And you look at the whole top five. I beat every single one of them except for Amir Albazi. And Amir Albazi was a person that I'm trying to fight, you know? So it's just like, I'm not ducking from any of these top fighters in the world. I just want to cement my legacy of being one of those dudes who's fighting his ass off every chance he gets and taking all the best fighters and best options in the world. And that's another thing with the whole Moreno thing. And that's like what I was thinking in my head too, is just like, this is a number one ranked fighter. This is a former champion. And I'm going to take it on short notice in his hometown and win this fight. And that's to cement my legacy. That's to be undeniable, you know? And sure, it's a big risk, but it's a big reward too. Now I have a number one next to my name, and I have a little bit of a leveraging, and anybody after they win is saying my name right now. It's a Makayev, all that stuff. And it's just like, that's all really good stuff is I'm being talked about. You know what I'm saying? And that's what I need.
Could you even do that and turn it around and maybe do Noche UFC here at the Spear?
That would be the coolest thing ever, man. That would be the coolest thing ever. And like I said, I'm not trying to be one of those guys that like win a belt and then I take 6 months. I'm trying to make a lot of money this year. I'm trying to make a lot of money throughout this rest of my UFC career. And it's like, I'm not going to ever sit back. That would be the dopest thing, to fight in the Spear. To fight in any of these like big cards is something that I want, you know? And it's going to help me. It's going to boost my notoriety. It's going to do all that stuff. You know, I fight fun. Like, I have fun fights. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, all this is going to cement my legacy in a good way. And to fight Pantoja and beat him in Brazil would be amazing. And then to go fight that Sphere would be even doper. Like, those would all be really cool ideals.
Brandon, so I'll put a couple cards out on the table here for people who don't know. We've been interviewing you for a very long time. Brandon Moreno lives like 10 minutes from us. So we've always talked to him as well. The night of the fight, as we're watching all this play out, you're right, we were kind of confused with scores too. At some point, we thought, are we not watching this properly or what? Because when the last horn sounded, we just felt like there wasn't even really a doubt if Moreno had won the fight. It's nothing against him. It just felt like you just did more than him. But I want to ask how you got to that, because the first thing people are going to say is, hey, it looked like Brandon had an off night. And maybe he could have had a little bit of that. But to me, it felt like you just didn't give him room to breathe, to do anything. I couldn't, I hate to say, I was almost doubting you at the beginning, because I was like, he can't keep that pace up, you know, for five rounds. And you did it. You just kept going. Like, what is it that changed? What was it strategy wise? What is it that you saw that you were able to put on that, for me, was almost a perfect performance, man? And you were kind of banged up in the fight.
Yeah. I feel like, yeah, I've been hearing that a lot too. And I don't necessarily know what his strategy is, but I know what my strategy was going into that fight. And my strategy was to stay super long, kick, and then keep a distance where anytime Brandon Moreno threw, he would almost have to overcommit. And that's exactly what was happening. Is just I stood super long. I stood kind of out of, like, he was throwing jabs or like doing anything but committing fully to his strikes. He was not gonna land on me. And that's what you see, like that's where, like, every punch he landed was him throwing 100%, moving out of position and kind of putting himself in bad positions. And I needed that because, one, I'm one of the longer guys in the division. I can fight from a distance. And two, I need to stop these takedowns, and I need distance on that too. So it's just two of those things where I'm like, I need to fight Brandon Moreno long. I need to fight him, you know, I need to keep pressure on him for sure, but I need to fight him long and be smart about it. And I feel like those first two rounds, he's just trying to cover distance, you know, and I could be wrong. Maybe something was off with him or wrong that night. But in my opinion, it's like, I'm bigger, I'm longer. I could fight longer. I have longer legs. It's like, from then that looked like a guy that was trying to cover distance, and he had to overcommit to all of his strikes, and it looked sloppy and it didn't look good. But it's also just like, I'm long and I fight long, you know, and I could fight long. So there's moments where he starts shouting up, then I can close distance a little better. But for the most part, I was just trying to stay out of his range and stay out of boxing range. And anytime he came in, he had to overcommit. And that was literally our game plan going into it. It's just, I want to make Brandon Moreno miss big. I want him to overcommit. And then I wanted to capitalize once he overcommitted. And I still was getting hit by some of the shots that he was throwing. But that being said, is everything he did was a lot of overcommitment, and it looks sloppy to a degree, but it's also just like, I'm long, you know, I'm a real long fighter.
So those adjustments that you were able to make for that fight, is it safe to say that you've already kind of recalculated what you would do against Pantoja? Do you feel like you've already addressed all that in your head, what needs to be corrected, and kind of the same way you had the feeling going into the Moreno fight?
Yeah. Yeah. And I know it probably sounds insane to anybody who been, you know, keeping up with Myron and Pantoja's career, but it's just like, I think I could beat that dude tomorrow. Like, in my head, I know I could beat that guy. I know he's an amazing fighter, an amazing champion, and like, I'm a huge fan of his style, but I know I could beat that dude tomorrow. Like, I know I could beat him within 8 weeks. I know I could beat him in 7 weeks or whatever it is. UFC 301, I know I can come up with a game plan that'll beat him. And you know, I made some quick adjustments after the Pantoja fight for sure. But maybe I had to just adjust my mental state on, like, with Pantoja, I was so afraid to get my back taken. I wasn't taking risk. I was doing a lot of stuff that was more unlike me, where I was just kind of laying off the gas, not taking risk, and just trying to play it as it goes. And that was a big mistake on my behalf, where I felt like Pantoja did a lot of great adjustments in that fight.
Have you spoken to the UFC? Have they given you any inclination that you're in the pole position, for example, or that they were waiting on the Mokaev fight? Have you heard anything like that that tells you what might be next?
No, not at all. I have no clue what's about to happen. I knew I put myself in a good position by winning that Moreno fight and taking that fight with Moreno.
Yeah, for sure.
But other than that, it's like, I don't know. You know, I don't know what's about to happen at all, and I don't know who they even have in mind, or if Horiguchi's going to come, or any of those stuff. So I really have no clue, but I feel like I put myself in one of the best positions in the division as far as making that.
Is that a rumor you've heard, that Horiguchi might be coming?
That's a rumor I heard. I don't know if there's any truth to that. I just keep seeing it, you know?
That's interesting. Yeah. He was dope in the UFC. I think he was like 7-1. His only loss was to Johnson. Then yeah, outside the UFC, he won some belts, so he's legit. I like him.
Yeah, he's one of my favorites to watch. It sucks he's going back to flyweight and you have to fight him, but as far as watching him at 35 and then watching him outside the UFC, it's been some cool stuff. You know, he's done a lot of really good things, and I feel like he'd be such a great addition to the UFC.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you cleared that up, because a lot of people will say, hey, you just fought, Pantoja won a lot of rounds against you. But you're saying the tweaks are there, the adjustments are there. This can be a competitive fight, and you can do it in 2 months. We don't question the cardio because that was beastly what you did. I'm wrong. It's about 7,800 feet altitude, not 10,000, but certainly more than a mile high, which is where you train. Still incredible, that pace that you put on.
Yeah, bro, and that's like another thing too, is I feel like with these fights, with the Pantoja fight and now the Moreno fight, it's like I feel like I could have pushed it even harder. Like I definitely could have pushed the pace a little harder. And you know, you get these 25 minute fights and you realize you're like, okay, this isn't even bad, you know. And it's like I could do it in training camp, but like you'll never know in a fight because fights are different, man. I see people who have good cardio gas out in the first round, you know. And fights are a lot different, but now it's like I know I can even push the pace harder than that Moreno fight, and that's what I'm aiming to do every fight now.
Maybe you can answer this, but Pantoja looks like he gasses, but somehow that dude digs deep and will squeeze out a round when you don't think he can. It looks like he's fading, and it looks like it, with a couple of shots, the exhaustion along with getting hit cleanly, like he could go out. How does this guy do it, man? I got to give him his due.
Yeah. Oh, me too, man. There was like a video clip I seen of me kneeing him flush. Like he changed levels. I threw a knee up the middle. He eats it on the chin and just ran through a takedown. I'm like, this guy is literally the Terminator. Pantoja's the Terminator for sure. I feel like he's earned that nickname in the division. I don't even like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't even know anybody close. It's just like that fool can absorb shots and then walk through them. And including with the whole cardio thing, it's like that guy can push through adversity, and it's like that's what makes him a champion, that's what makes him great, and that's what makes him one of my favorite like fighters in the flyweight division. It's just like, you know, I felt like he fought me a little boring, but I think that's just the nature of like also him giving me respect on who I am too, of like just nullifying and playing the positions really smart. But as far as any other fight, Pantoja had to be like one of my favorite fighters to watch. He's so entertaining, he has such a killer instinct, he can knock people out, he can submit people, and it's just like, yeah, that guy's dope. Like, but you know, fuck him. Not to fight him.
Do your coaches want to fly to Brazil and spoil the party? Like, does your team get off on anime territory, kind of isolating yourself? There's no family, no friends. You just go to work, kind of like Rocky IV theme.
Yeah. I feel like to a degree, yeah. If they give us the fight, they have no choice. But I feel like a lot of what we were saying in the back room and like what we were saying all week is just silencing a crowd. And
right.
And that's just kind of like the goal with any of these fights where you're in enemy's territory. Is just like, you know, even with the Moreno fight, it's like I wasn't really getting booed after the decision was there. It was just more silence than anything. And it's like, I want to silence a crowd. I want them to be like, all right, well, you can't say shit about that one, you know what I'm saying? And I feel like that's the goal.
Incredible what you did. And yeah, you've owned most of that division. Pantoja's got the two. Moreno could have been two up, but you nullified that. You would have been in a tough spot on it, if I'm being honest with you. But
yeah, 100%.
You're totally out
you're
of that.
Walking out knowing that. You're like, damn, did I do everything right? Was this a fucking dumb decision? That's what I was thinking on the walkout. I was like, I looked at my coaches and I'm like, was this a dumb decision? Should I have waited? Or like, you know what I'm saying? But
yeah, no, man, seriously, that was gutsy, ballsy, everything. And now a lot of us are willing to watch a third fight, even though it recently happened. Yeah. So whatever plays out, I have a feeling you're fighting for a title in 2024. If it can happen early for you and you're down, body can sustain all that, then, you know, go for it. Thank you, Brandon, for the time today. It was cool to see you and Oso again. And seriously, your story is incredible, man. You know, like I say, just you, every time you've kind of gotten hit, you know, by dropping a fight, you come back with a streak and you dig deep. That's pretty cool to see.
Yeah, man. I feel like that's been my story. So it makes sense for me winning a belt off of a losing a belt title shot. You know, I feel like that's what happened with me in the LFA too, is I took a short, like I took a title shot against Casey McKinney. I lost. I won a fight, won a big fight off a guy that just got cut from the UFC. And once I won that fight, they put me back in for title contention. Then I go win the LFA belt and get signed to the UFC. So it's just like, I feel like this kind of fits my legacy a little bit.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Well, thanks again for the time, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, you too. Have a good day.
All right, see you. He's not scared to hop on a plane and head to Rio de Janeiro in a few months.
He's gotten pretty gangster, hasn't he?
He sure has, but he knows this is the time. And he says the body is conditioned to go 25, whatever it takes. He got soundly beat against Pantoja, so I hope he feels like he has improved in the last, by the time they fight, it will have been 6 months. Did he really work on stuff and improve? We'll see, but it could also go to Muhammad Mokaev.
He just completely surprised me the way he fought Brandon Moreno. I would have never thought that fight would have gone down the way it went down. So I'm willing to, based off of a performance like that, I'm willing to overlook his fight with Pantoja and say, all right, well, maybe the guy's just made corrections in his game, you know?
Let's keep talking about UFC 299. But before that, let's squeeze these two stories out, and then we'll finish up with a strong MMA run. So Francis Ngannou boxed Anthony Joshua. And in the second round, he got KTFO'd. There's no other way to put it. He got knocked down twice before the final knockout. And that knockout was as vicious as I've seen in the sport of boxing. He's 0-2 now. Yes, the fight with Fury was close. Yes, you could call it for Francis. But no, it wasn't a robbery to call it for Fury, in my opinion. I just feel like when he did that, like, I can't turn back the clock, but I wish he almost would have left it at that. At just the Fury fight, and that was it, and gone back to MMA. But now he fought Joshua. He rolled the dice. It didn't come through. Now he's technically 0-2. And whoever wins out of Fury and usage, if it's Fury, I could see it being a fight. I don't see Ngannou and usage being a big fight, but what do I know? I just want to see him back in MMA, but I'm in no hurry after that vicious KO.
No, definitely. Like, the guy's going to need a lot of time, I think, before we see him in any form of combat. But I think it's pretty obvious that the boxing run is I don't want to say it's gone completely dead, but it's hit its course for now. You know, like, that fight really, really showed what a high-level boxer can do against somebody who's just a striker, you know, coming into boxing. You have to give Francis Ngannou his props for everything he's done, the way he's approached everything, but he was outboxed really, really badly. And these are heavyweights. They can do real damage to you. It's not like just because you're crossing back into MMA that didn't happen. You're still carrying that KO. And I'll tell you one thing, man. You're probably carrying two KOs. Because in boxing, that second knockdown, he was probably a little concussed from that too. And guess what they do in boxing? Hey, take a minute. Come back. Get another one. That doesn't really happen in MMA. Usually there's some kind of closure to that, you know, your opponent pounces on you and finishes the job. So he's probably got two concussions or something, but a rough night for him. Made a big gang of money. Go spend that money. Take some time off. Do nothing. Then ease your way back into mixed martial arts training and then take on a fight.
And remember we said, hey, this Fajita fight might be more evenly matched than we thought. Well, guess what? Since then, he's taken two knockdowns. He's had a knockout, and he's further removed from his last MMA fight. So, yeah, I don't want to see it anytime soon. I'd rather see it at the end of 2024. Let's see how it goes versus Fajita. Maybe he can add a belt. Maybe he can help PFL grow, which is something that he wanted. But, yeah, boxing, I don't want to see it. And here's why. I know when they show the replays in slow motion, it looks more exaggerated, right? The holes, the openings that are there. But I'm telling you, his defense was just so poor, and Joshua just capitalized on it. Like, as good as he kind of looked in that first fight, he didn't look as good in the second fight. It didn't look like he should stick around the sport, which is what Anthony Joshua told him, but I just don't see it. I don't see him. I mean, I don't think he could beat Joshua if he faced him again. I don't think he could beat Fury if he faced him again. And Usyk's beaten Joshua twice, and now he's got Fury ahead of him. And then Joseph Parker's pretty tough as well. Deontay Wilder's tough. I just don't. I mean, other than the money, as far as the competition side of it, I just don't see him flourishing there anymore. I feel like that experiment's done. I'm over it. Now let's see what happens in MMA. And the MMA experiment, let me tell you something. If he beats Fajita, and if he's made a lot of money, I'd like to see him just exit the sport altogether. He made a statement. I'm a world champion. I've beaten the PFL champion. I'll win a belt there if he beats Fajita. I was a UFC champion. I had a title defense. And I went over to boxing and went 10 rounds with the best heavyweight of that time. Mm-hmm. Like, I am a pretty damn good combat sports fighter. I don't think I need any more.
Yeah, I could agree with that. Because
the exception, if there's a huge Fury fight early next year, late next year, okay. Because I don't think Fury can knock him out the way Joshua can. I think he could do it with a multitude of punches, but not one shot. Mm-hmm. And then the other one that I would say is too big to pass up is Jones, if somehow they cross paths again. But everything else, I don't know. I think he made his point already.
What you could do is go to the PFL, fight, try and get that win, and then call it a day on your MMA career. Go back to boxing. It doesn't mean you have to fight one of these top three guys, right? Let's just say he made, I don't know, what, 30, 40 million, something like that, right? Let's say he made that. Can't you just fight a lower level fighter for 2 million, 3 million, 4 million, 5 million? I don't know. And maybe rack up a couple wins where you can get that one more shot at a more aging Tyson Fury or something like that, you know? But just to go in and just fight another top 10 guy, like, to me, that doesn't make sense. You know, you're 0-2. You just suffered a really bad knockout. You have to learn how to box. Box for boxing, not MMA. And because this is a dangerous sport. You can't just go in there and fight these heavy hitters and get KO'd. That ain't fun. But could you go back and maybe fight a little bit more down towards the rankings and build yourself up? Maybe.
I don't think he wants to do that. Fight.
Then he's going to get knocked out again, I think.
That's what I'm saying. I think boxing is just the experience done. And I think he did a great job. Even though he went 0-2, I thought he did a great job. Way better than a lot of other MMA fighters. He made his point. We know he can kick Fury and Joshua's ass in the same night in the streets or in MMA. But in boxing, he just couldn't do it.
I'll put it to you in punch-out terms. You just finished fighting Tyson and Super Macho Man. Take a break and come back and fight Bald Bull. Fight Soda Popinski. And then maybe we can entertain another big fight. But to just come back and say, hey, Mr. Sandman, what are you doing? Like, nah, that ain't going to go well.
We'll see. Like I say, I'd just rather see him not box anymore. He's not a boxer. He experimented. He's an MMA guy with boxing skills. He proved his point. We're done.
You can't say he's not a boxer. Against
Andy Ruiz or anyone else, like, you know.
You can't say he's not a boxer, though, because going 10 rounds with Tyson Fury, regardless if that's Tyson Fury's off night, a guy of that level, his off night should still destroy a guy's first night in boxing. You know what I mean? He's developed some boxing. He's just not world class.
Mm-hmm.
Conor McGregor.
Well, I don't think a promoter wants to promote him unless it's someone that's a big fighter. Look, he's still getting paired up against Tyson Fury, and that fight most likely will happen, especially if he loses the usage. But it looks like they want to make it. That's a big fight. You know, we're talking about lots of million dollars. I just don't see him regressing and going back to a $2 million fight against an Andy Ruiz or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of Tyson versus Jake Paul? Mike Tyson versus Jake Paul has been signed. We don't know the details yet, other than it takes place in the summer in Arlington, Texas. I think it may even be at Jerry's World. However, we don't know if it's going to be a pro fight, exhibition bout, what the rules will be. But I think we all have at least an initial reaction within us. What's yours?
I don't like it. This is just an old fighter. He looks great when we watch videos of him and we go, I still got it, you know. Well, there's one thing of being able to put it together for cameras, and there's another to be able to do it in combat while somebody else is hitting you too. And that's not to say that Jake Paul is a world beater or anything like that, but he's a strong kid. He's a quick kid. I'm not saying Tyson can't beat him. Maybe he can. Who knows? But I just don't need to see it.
I'm kind of into it. And I think Tyson's going to decapitate him.
Think so?
Yeah. because I think he'll be ready to go the 8 to 10 rounds, whatever they decide on. I think he still packs power.
The one thing Jake Paul isn't is stupid. And he picked a good state, you know, where you get some pretty crazy scorecards. I bet you that ring is going to be a lot bigger. There'll be things that'll work to his advantage. I don't know how crazy he's going to get in the lead up to everything with Mike Tyson, because you have to remember this is kind of like a Netflix thing and he's going to want to entertain, you know, but I don't know how far you can take it with a guy like Mike Tyson, those fun and games. But I'm going to be watching, that's for sure. Yeah, but I'm not a big fan of it.
Me too. I can't wait to tell you the truth. I know a lot of people completely hate it. They feel like the young guy's picking on an old washed up guy or whatever. Look, they're both going to make a ton of money. And if they both pass the medicals, let's do it. Seems like Tyson still has all his marbles. But I just feel like he didn't rush into anything after Roy Jones. That was like 3 years ago. In fact, Jake Paul was on the undercard of that night, if I'm not mistaken. So let's see what this does. It has nothing to do with rankings or somebody becoming a title challenger or nothing like that. It's just pure entertainment. Mm-hmm. That's all it is. I'm here for it. All right, let's get back to UFC 299. Here are the rest of the results. Michael Page defeated Kevin Holland. Jack Della Maddalena defeated Gilbert Burns. Pyotr Yan defeated Song Yadong. Curtis Blaydes defeated Jailton Almeida. Macy Barber defeated Caitlin Cermenera. Mateus Gamero defeated Rafael Dos Anjos. Kyla Phillips defeated Pedro Munhoz. Felipe Lenz defeated Jan Kutalaba. Michelle Fajeda defeated Mike Mikal. Olenechnik. That's a tough one. Rebelis de Spain defeated Josh Parisian. Asu Almabayev defeated CJ Vergara. And Joanne Wood defeated Marina Moroz. A lot of these fights were decisions. In fact, the only finish on the prelims was Despaigne versus Parisian. The only finish on the featured prelims, so that was the early prelims. Here's the featured prelims, was Blaydes over Almeida. And on the main card, we had two finishes, Jack Della Maddalena and Dustin Poirier. All the finishers got 50,000. So that includes Despaigne, Pajeda, Blaydes, Della Maddalena, and then they gave a performance of the night to Sean O'Malley. I'm not hating on that. That guy went for it, man, and he was active for 25 minutes. And then they gave Dustin Poirier fight of the night along with VSD, and that's fine. I guess that was the fight of the night. They don't always have to go the distance or nothing like that, but they didn't give Poirier a finish bonus because I'm sure they pay him well to begin with, and he got fight of the night. At least that's what Dana White said. So I'm kind of fine with it. You know me, I love it when they can sprinkle a little bit to all the finishers at least. So I am happy in that regard.
Yeah, I think all of that makes sense. I don't know, man. Like, even though they were a lot of decisions, to me it was just fun. It did make for a long day, long night. But that card, I think if you were there, you would have had a blast because it just... the way it went from fight to fight, like different scenarios, it just kept me entertained the entire night. I was super, super happy. There were some weird moments, you know, you want to talk about Curtis Blaydes?
Yeah, I do want to say one thing. Out of the first 8 fights, 7 went to a decision. So that's why the night was off to a slow start. But yeah, when they get to Blaydes and Almeida, that means there's 6 fights left. That one, which is the main event of the featured prelims, and then the 5 on the pay-per-view. And after that, those last 6 fights, 6 of them, or half of them, 3 of them were finishes. But yeah, let's talk about it. You know, Almeida just owned him in round 1, just kept taking him down over and over and over. He kept attacking with submissions, but he never really got close. And then Blaydes comes out in the second round, and as Almeida's trying to take him down yet again, Blaydes starts delivering strikes to the side of the head. Almeida still keeps holding on to a single, and then all of a sudden, boom, he flops because one of those hurt him, and he was done. Blaydes finished him off. second round TKO.
Yeah, I didn't understand Jelton Almeida's strategy there, because I get that he's going for the takedown. That's something that had been successful for him, shockingly. Nobody really saw that on their punch card. But when, after, you just can't at a high level take unprotected punches like that over and over and over. I think after two, you have to figure out either I need to move my head or I need to disengage or something has to change. Worst case scenario, we're on the ground. That's where I want to be anyway, right? Just to take those over and over and over. I think he's going to look back at that fight and just be pissed off, because he had the opportunity to do something that a lot of people don't do to that guy, and kind of give us a fresh name in the heavyweight division that we feel like can contend at the top. We have a lot of these guys that can kind of dwell in the pool at the bottom, but we, you know, there's 3-4 guys on the diving board. Everybody else is just in the pool, nicking at each other. That guy had an opportunity to kind of take a step forward, and I think we're all impressed by what he did early, but the ending just shows he's not ready for the top yet.
Yeah, I agree. And Blades has been doing this for such a long time, so surviving round one, I had a feeling he was going to do good with the fight going forward. I said as much on the watch along. It just felt like Almeida was going to be frustrated that after doing everything that he did, he couldn't really rack up nothing other than a 10-9. Pewter Young and Song Yadong. Look, that one went to a decision, but it was close. Round three decided it. Pewter Young came out ahead. He looked leaner, fresher, rejuvenated, refreshed. And now he's got Song Yadong behind him. He says he wants a big fight. He's thinking... he was calling someone out. Who was it? Go ahead and give me your thoughts on Song Yadong and Yan, and I want to look at it because I know I saw a headline here of what Yan was thinking going forward.
I think even in a loss, Song Yadong doesn't lose too much. I thought he looked pretty damn good, but I thought Yan just looked incredible. That whatever the recipe was going into this camp, into this fight, whatever he did, replicate that. Keep doing that, because he looked great. He kept that kid off balance all night. And I want to see more of him. I do think he deserves a big fight, because if you look at his fight record, the losing streak is not really telling the real story there. To us, it looked like, oh my God, something needs to happen, or this could be the end. We're just never going to see the old Pewter Young. That was not the case, man. That kid still showed that he's got it and he can contend at the top.
It says here on Junkie that he wants Sean O'Malley or Merab Dvalishvili to begin his rematch season.
No.
Well, he's not going to get O'Malley, and I think Dvalishvili is going to get O'Malley, so he's going to have to settle for Nurmagomedov, Sanhagen, Cejudo, one of those guys. But yeah, I agree with you. You look great. As far as the rest of the fight card goes, we had Gilbert Burns and Jack Della Maddalena. I thought they were tied up 1-1. Burns is kind of riding Maddalena towards the end of that fight, right? He's kind of trying to secure a good position on the ground where he can hold him down and maybe ground and pound his way to a 10-9 in that round, thereby taking a decision. At least that's what we found out when they revealed the cards later. Instead, Della Maddalena creates a scramble opportunity and then finishes Gilbert Burns. He starts things off with a knee, another vicious knee, and then some follow-up strikes, and he got his hand raised.
That was heartbreaking. You know, the whole night there was this theme of kind of like older fighters that are closer to being on their way out versus younger fighters. RDA was one of those guys too, right? Dustin Poirier was another one. In this particular fight, you felt like Gilbert Burns had to do everything right to get this victory. And he kind of did. I thought he looked impressive. I thought he gave it his all. It was just one little mistake that led to the demise of Gilbert Burns in that fight. And now his road back was already pretty long. Now it's really long. Like, he's got to reassess his career and what it is he wants to get out of these last couple years of competition that he has.
Yeah, no doubt. He already took the time off too between the last time when he fought like three times in 5 months. But that was, you know, some vicious ground and pound at the end. So I'd like to see him not fight till the end of the year. But he still shows me he's one of the top mm-hmm. cats in his division. He can't seem to, you know, turn the corner on some of the better fighters like he used to. And some of it might be due to age. And yeah, that was a theme because we had Gilbert Burns was like 10 years older than Madalena. And then we had an age difference between Barber and Sermonero. That was about 10 years. Gamrot and RDA was somewhere around there. Phillips and Pedro Munoz. So all the young fighters were getting over in the older fighters. And that theme continued with Della Maddalena over Gilbert Burns. We get to Michael Page, who debuted after signing over as a free agent from Bellator. He defeated Kevin Holland. Now, look, this one had the makings of being, you know, a vicious ending. And MVP was certainly more active than I've seen him in the past. And I thought he kind of made it exciting. He's kind of a counter striker. But Holland was frustrated. It seemed like he tuned out at times. And the fight went to a decision. So that kind of sucked a little bit. But in the end, Dana White seemed pretty pleased with Michael Venom Page. And, you know, at least he got his first fight with the UFC under his belt.
I thought that was a very odd stance from Dana White. Because I feel like if another fighter had fought that fight, he would be criticizing them. I don't know what it is about him and MVP, but he's shown MVP a lot of love. And MVP was entertaining at time. Had his own custom walkout. He did things in that cage that we don't normally see from other fighters. But the fans didn't seem to be too into it. They were booing at times. They didn't like it too much, so I thought it was an odd response from Dana White. Can MVP continue to win? Like, if you match him up with the right guys, I think you can, but eventually he's going to have to change that fighting style when he faces somebody that shows any type of threat of a takedown or something. That's going to have to change. We've seen that change in fights in Bellator, and when that happens, he kind of just closed shells it a little bit, and people criticize him for not opening up as much, so we'll have to see. We'll have to see how this MVP experiment goes. I mean, there are people that just tune in to see somebody get knocked out, you know, because they talk too much smack, or maybe he'll fall into that role. But look, if you look at MVP's record, you go up and down. You don't have to usually wait too long before you get to some kind of devastating KO. And those are the type of things that put you on the map.
I think what saved MVP was, when he did explode, he would land cleanly on Holland, usually his face, right? His jaw or something like that. And those shots are exciting. And the way he covers so much ground and just kind of snaps at you and he's so fast, they kind of make up. So it's like you're on the verge of booing because there's not a lot going on. And then just when you're about to boo or react, boom, he'd give you something. Mm-hmm. I wish he would have gotten the finish, whoever, either one. You know, Holland was trying to threaten from the ground. MVP was trying to threaten from the feet. But we didn't get it. So that's why the night was needing something. We got it from Della Maddalena. We didn't get it from this fight. But then Poirier gave it to us. And then O'Malley and Vera was pretty exciting, even though that went to a decision. But I thought it was a great debut for him. But I did hear Dana White clearly say that they're just going to have to use the right type of matchmaking for him going forward. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what that means. I don't know if that means give him the Wonder Boys of the world or just others that want to maybe strike with him or something like that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you can, because when you hear MVP talk, he's talking about titles and you just can't make it to a title shot. You're going to run into somebody that's going to want to fight a little different, whether it's a Bilal Muhammad, a Colby Covington. There are guys with just different skill sets. You can't avoid them. A guy like Wonderboy Thompson, it's a name that kept getting thrown around when they signed MVP. And I get it. I get why people want to see it, but they're represented by the same guy. So more than likely, they're going to want to avoid that. And then two, I actually think that'll turn into a bad matchup because Stephen Thompson is one of those guys that he'll hold back. He's willing to hear the boos, as long as he gets to fight his type of fight, I think those guys are just going to be fainting in front of each other for 3 minutes at a time. I don't think you're going to get the action that you think you're going to get out of Stephen Thompson and MVP.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. We'll see what happens next, who they book him against. There's some pretty solid fighters out there. One of the guys that was in Burns' corner, Vicente Luque, he's kind of been frozen out of some fights. So maybe he'll entertain MVP next. We'll see. Mm-hmm. Hey, what did you think of Joanna Jędrzejczyk? She's announced as the next Modern Wing UFC Hall of Fame inductee.
I think it made sense. It's I think we all felt when she retired that it was just a matter of time when we would see this, because she crosses all the T's, right? Became a champion, defended her belt, brought a little bit of an edge to the sport, where right around the time we were starting to lose Ronda Rousey, this was a girl that kind of had that same edginess to her, would get in people's faces in the stare downs. And she was a high level striker. You know, she put beatings on some people. So I think she marked all the boxes. She definitely deserves to be in there.
Oh yeah. She won the title twice, and she defended it 5 times, if I'm not mistaken. I'm checking here, because once it comes out of my mouth, I want to make sure I'm right. She defended it. Let's see here. 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, 5 title defenses. And I apologize. She didn't regain the belt. Once she lost it to Rose, that was it. I forgot she fought for the vacant flyweight title against Valentina. Lost that one. And even though she beat Tisha Torres and Michelle Waterson on the way out, she lost both of her fights versus Zhang Weili. So still impressive 5 title defenses. Definitely deserves it. Dana White seems to love her. He's speaking very highly of her in the post-fight press conference. Seems like he always wanted to be part of the UFC family, maybe work as an ambassador. Who knows? But I thought it was well-deserved. I have no problem with it. I still feel like there's a lot of veterans that need to go in first, but they're in another wing, so she's not taking the spot of like a Dan Henderson. He would go in the Pioneer wing, so she's not taking a spot. I have no problem with her joining Frankie Edgar, both in the Modern wing.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah. So the gate officially, by the way, was the attendance was 14,000. No. The gate was 14 million. I'm sorry. The gate was 14 million, and the sellout was like 19,165, and the gate was $14,142,000. These are big gates. These are like Madison Square Garden gates. Mm-hmm. So I know the UFC wants to go back. I don't know if they'll do it twice in 1 year, but the fans were saying, hey, give us UFC 305, which would be the one right before UFC 306, which is the one at the Sphere in September. So that's pretty creative. You know, that's the area code, one of the area codes down in Miami, 305. I like it.
Yeah.
But we'll see. But they represented just like they did last year.
Wasn't there like a movement to try and do 209 in Stockton once or something like that?
Yes, except Stockton hasn't sold big fights yet. So I think Northern California, man, I've been there a few times, and there's some hardcore fans that go to Sacramento, San Jose. I wish they would try going back there, but they just kind of haven't. I think after the pandemic, they went to a lot of red states. Mm-hmm. And since then, it's either been there or the Apex, or they just gone international. But I would love to see them start hitting some cities throughout mm-hmm. the United States, like the old days. Let's wrap up. That's our UFC 299 recap. Hope you all enjoyed that. Hope you all enjoyed the interview with Brandon Royval. And of course, tomorrow day, we'll be doing Spinning Backlick live at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, myself. Goes Nolan King and Big John McCarthy. Should be a fun show. And if you don't know about Spinning Backlick, you can go to the website 5 minutes before, so you'll see all the links to get there, or go straight through our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/official MMA junkie, or go to our YouTube page, youtube.com/MMA junkie video. All right, folks, we're going to bounce on out of here. Thanks for always tuning in. We'll catch you on the next one. Go out and be a champion.